Bordelli, who now became a deputy foreign minister for Subasic. Six capitalist ministers walked in and were given cabinet posts with or without portfolios. It was characterized here as a Trojan horse policy, followed by the coalition and by the Kremlin, agreed to by the Kremlin. Now, it's wrong to dismiss this as a mere episode. It marked a new stage in dual power, the emergence of a new dual power system, with the Trojan horse policy apparently in reverse. Because from all indications, the bourgeois ministers were virtual captives in Tito's cabinet. At any rate, Foreign Minister Subasic was. At the first Big Five Council meeting of ministers held in London during the Tito-Subasic regime, it was attended by Cardelli and not Subasic, who was reported from Belgrade by someone obviously with a sense of humor that he had suffered an apoplectic stroke and couldn't go. Later, Subasic almost had an apoplectic fit, denying it. In any case, Cardelli was foreign minister de jure, if not de facto, in the coalition government after Subasic and company walked in. Now, what happened then? These gentlemen, whom Churchill Stalin agreed upon, and Tito Cardelli admitted, started filing out. By the end of October, the last two also left. Who remained behind? The one and the same party, the one and the same leaders. Now, if the original March entrance of these six capitalists was no more than an episode, it is difficult to understand why the October exit of the last two should have heralded a qualitative transformation. Namely, bringing into being a new worker state within a certain time. To put it mildly, such a point of view leaves one a little irritated. What is particularly irritating is that if anything is a theoretical novelty, it's this conception of dual power being solved not through a succession of dual power systems, but through a workers-peasants government, next a coalition government, and finally the dictatorship of the proletariat. Three distinct types of states. Dual, capitalist, workers. Now, I'm not resolved in principle to the novelty of it. But I don't like novelties introduced, especially in theory, which had not recognized as such openly, thoroughly discussed, following a theoretical motivation explanation, just how this theory squares with our orthodox Marxist doctrine. I'm confident such oversights will be remedied and a whole new proposal carefully reviewed. I'm considerably over the time limit already, and I haven't even come to the fifth peculiarity, and that is the role of the international factors in this dual power process. I must now skip to the outstanding features, which in my opinion, in the light of the above theoretical motivation, lead me to conclude that a dual power system still rules over Yugoslavia. Question must naturally be answered, where are the seats of bourgeois power? I've already mentioned the convulsive character of the regime in its policies, in its shifts, so characteristic not only of centrism, but also of dual power systems. Let me here say that I'm sorry that some of our co-thinkers are suggesting that we redefine the character of the Yugoslav party and call it a revolutionary party with right-wing deviations. Our majority resolution does not do so. The proposed resolution, no matter what adjectives you add to it, remains a definition of the Bolshevik party of Lenin. And we cannot accept that resolution, that definition. Second, you must list the peasantry. Does there exist a correlation of forces between the proletariat and the peasantry in Yugoslavia as permits a lasting stabilization of a single regime. You must answer the question, how did the peasants, especially the well-to-do and the rich, emerge from the civil war? Weakened, the state. You must weigh their specific weight. Far from there being an alliance, it appears as if there's a growing rift, especially in the recent period. Behind this huge mass of private proprietors, well-to-do and rich by Yugoslav standards, there stands, of course, the power of American world imperialism. Far from an alliance with the peasantry being maintained on any stable basis, you have a situation that is further aggravated by the current threat of famine. Now, you can't just dismiss that aside. You've got to evaluate it. And you can't just evaluate it for future perspective. You must evaluate it in terms of the present and the past as well. Now, please don't let anyone go out of here saying that right apparently favors collectivization, forced collectivization in Yugoslavia, and then might be prepared to call it a worker state. I don't mean this at all. Let me give you the third seat of bourgeois power, and I hope no one will be so like-minded to deny that the peasantry in Yugoslavia is a pretty mighty lever. Dual power finds its expression in the relationships between the bureaucracy and the party ranks, between the bureaucracy and the working class as a whole. It would be a grave error to underestimate the importance of recent reforms. They show how vigorous the revolution is, how very much alive it is. But it would be an equally big blunder to exaggerate their scope and meaning. One field has remained virtually untouched by reforms, and that is the Yugoslav Communist Party, the ruling party. There is one source of bureaucratic power and privilege that remains to all intents and purposes a virtual monopoly of the bureaucracy. And that was that determines the promulgation of its policies with such ease, apparent ease. And that's no trifle. If any single factor has prevented the Yugoslav working class from fully entering the historical arena, it is this relationship between the bureaucratic tops and the ranks inside the Yugoslav party. It is this that has served as the major internal obstacle to the speed of socialist consciousness among the masses and blocked the entry of the Yugoslav party and its cadre further on the road to Trotskyism. Now, the importance of such a subjective factor, especially after what has already been said in a majority report, I don't think needs to be dwelt on. So far as I can understand, there is a tendency among the majority to evaluate the Yugoslav processes in the following way. Everything that shows a shift to the right, say that's accidental, secondary, episodic. Everything that is except the latest development, which I completely agree with Comrade Weiss. Only I don't think that's conclusive either. It's too early to say how conclusive that shift is. That condition may continue for a while yet. We may get, as I am confident we will, further shifts, not only to the right, but also to the left. But on the other hand, every move to the left is considered as absolutely conclusive, irrevocable. Now, you can't view either the reforms or the nationalizations, even the struggle against bureaucracy, as being definitive, as having their fate decided, any more than you can view the course of the Tito regime to remain independent of both Kremlin and Washington. as having been decided. If you do so, you fall into a trap. And that's not at all unimportant, because you can never draw historical generalizations from episodic developments. And some comrades seem to forget that to proclaim the birth of a new dictatorship of the proletariat is to draw a very important historical generalization. I have to skip the entire list of the shortcomings in the majority position. One I must point out, however, and that is, can you evaluate historical results separate and apart from the leadership and program by which it is achieved? And can these historical results prove superior to that leadership and to that party? That's a very important innovation in our movement. Marx and Engels said it can be done. Lenin was just as emphatic. So was Trotsky. Before we say that a centrist leadership and program can achieve the same results as a genuine revolutionary party and program, that is a worker state, we should have all the overwhelming evidence that is needed to prove it. In conclusion, the majority formula for Yugoslavia is that of a victorious proletarian revolution, a worker state. That is also, of course, the formula of a completed revolution. Completed in the same sense and with the same results as was the Russian Revolution. Our co-thinkers originally defined it as a worker state with bureaucratic deformations. That is, word for word, how Lenin defined the young Yugoslav Republic. Our own majority resolution doesn't even bother with such qualifications. States flatly, a worker state. That's far too sweeping. You yourself will have to modify it, even if you persist in calling it a worker state. The outstanding merit of the resolution is that it recognizes that the proletarian revolution is occurring in Yugoslavia. And the need, not to say the enthusiasm, of intervening in it, coming to its defense, seeking to extend its conquests, seeking to guarantee the victory. Its chief fault is that it skips over so lightly over the entire period, declares something as resolved, which is not at all resolved, resolves it in a manner incompatible with our previous positions. The CPY and its leadership have won many important battles, but they have still to win the war for the proletarian dictatorship.
Comrades, I want the convention to understand precisely what I am doing here. I am making what amounts to a declaration on behalf of the Johnson Forest tendency. We are not debating the issues raised by Comrade Weiss about Yugoslavia or about state capitalism, nor the swinging of the Yugoslav pendulum as described by Comrade Wright. If we were doing that, we would have presented a resolution and requested a full-time reporter. The issue that matters for us is the related question. That is, It is the role of Stalinism. It is expressed very simply in the document presented by us to the party. We placed it at the very beginning of that document, and I want to read it for you. On page 4, we said, I quote, "The dilemma of the Fourth International is that it has to recognize that there now exists a labor bureaucracy which is the enemy of private property and national defense, and yet is counter-revolutionary. The Fourth International cannot escape this decision. If the destruction of private property and the repudiation of national defense are revolutionary, then Stalinism is revolutionary, and there is no historical need for a Fourth International. For us, all discussions are entirely subordinate to the question of the role of Stalinism. The danger is to begin with Yugoslavia and end with Stalinism as the leader of the revolution on a world scale. We made it clear from the start that it was the question of the program and the building of the party. We stated further in our bulletin, and I quote, "These are the questions with which the theory of state capitalism deals. The theory is not primarily concerned with defensism or defeatism in Russia, about which we can do very little. We are primarily concerned with what the refusal to accept this theory does to the party, to its solidarity, to its capacity to fight its enemies, its capacity to preserve itself and to grow. In brief, to prepare the liquidation of Stalinism. I want to repeat, we are concerned with the building of the party. And the building of the party is above all the question of the program. In our document, we characterized the position of Pablo very sharply. We considered his position a catastrophe for the international. Now, in over a year of party discussion, neither the majority reporter, Comrade Weiss, nor any other leading spokesman of the majority has dealt with Pablo. Yet that is the question. It is the central problem. The reporter now emphasizes that it is his position, in which he is on his own, and he says the fur can fly, that a process of elimination of capitalism is going on in the buffer zone while the real vital forces of the revolution have been crushed. That is his position. It is interesting, but we do not propose to debate with him. We want an official position. We want to know where the political committee stands on this question. We want to know, and our document shows that from the beginning we wanted to know where they stand in relation to Pablo. We want to know if they agree or disagree with him. We would like to know if they do agree, how and where they differentiate themselves from him and his 200-year perspective of degenerated worker states and the continued existence of a regenerated capitalism. We have stated that Pablo's tendency is a pro-Stalinist and liquidationist tendency. That we stand by. We shall make no more pronouncements in discussion in the party until we have an official document to debate against. You have known us now for some 3 years. You will have observed, I believe, that we are very careful in what we say and how we say it. We are going to be very careful here, as we have been in the past. We told you at the last convention that we were glad that the SWP was here for us to join. After 3 years, our original satisfaction is not only confirmed, but in every way increased. We believe that you also have found us to be good, loyal party members. But it would be wrong to disguise the fact that if the International and the leadership of the majority of the party come to the conclusion that Stalinism can lead the revolution, that would be a very serious thing for the party and therefore a very serious thing for us. That is why, in accordance with our usual practice, we are prepared to wait and see and to know what we are debating against, what is said, and who says it, so that we shall be able to characterize it with that care and precision which we have always exercised, even in the documents we issued in our interim period. Our position is known. No one can misunderstand it at all. The basis of the left opposition, the CLA, the SWP, the whole Fourth International, every line that Trotsky wrote after 1933 was that Stalinism was the gravedigger and syphilis of the revolution. Not Stalinism in Russia alone, but the Communist International, and today the common form, which our comrades in Italy, in France, in China, in India, have to fight against. We still believe them to be the gravedigger of the revolution. We still believe them to be the syphilis of the movement. We have posed this question consistently, almost from the very start of this discussion. We got no reply. And it is for that reason that we are prepared to wait until the comrades are ready. We find that a number of comrades suddenly display an intense interest in the theoretical aspects of state capitalism. That is progressive. But for 10 years, we have been writing on the theory of state capitalism. No one said a single word about what we have written. No one has yet written a line in answer to what we have put down on paper. That is your privilege. But it is also our privilege not to debate that now. And, as a matter of fact, we could not do so if we wanted to. Debate what? And with whom? We cannot debate against some remarks made by a reporter at a convention. When some authoritative person in leadership of the party writes a reply to the theoretical questions that we have raised, we can and will debate, not today, and not in place of the question whether Stalinism is the builder of the socialist society or the gravedigger and syphilis of the revolution. We do not say that the procedure that is being followed by the party at this convention is wrong. We don't say that for one single moment. We think that under the circumstances, it is as good a procedure as is possible. We do not attack the leadership for not having a position on this question. That would be mere sniping. That kind of politics we have not engaged in and will not go in for. The leadership is absolutely correct to say that it is not prepared to take a position for the time being, and the question is open until later. It cannot be said and will not be said by us that the SWP leadership avoids taking position on political questions. What we are putting forward is our situation. What we are saying is this: a minority, and a very small minority at that, cannot discuss everything, and that every time. We haven't got the forces for it. We haven't got the opportunity to do it. The party press is able to take up Yugoslavia from day to day. It is able to follow events in Korea and in Russia. It is able to take up everything that is happening in Eastern Europe or in China. In theory, we as a minority also are able to write whatever we please, as long as discussion lasts. But we cannot write a stream of documents in internal bulletins. We wear ourselves out and probably wear you out from reading them if we follow that course. You discuss one special case of exceptional circumstances today, and then you have to discuss another case of unique or exceptional circumstances. For example, I read in the press the other day that at a meeting some morning in Berlin, a Stalinist functionary stood up and declared that Eastern Germany was today a worker state. You could also read there in the press daily about others in Eastern Europe getting up to declare that their nations are now worker states with the Soviet form. No, we can't keep up with that. We have had a certain experience in discussing as a minority for many years. In fact, for some 10 years. We gain nothing from discussing in that manner. In the end, people get tired of discussion. And often before the actual core of discussion has been reached, the comrades begin to say, "We have had enough of this. Everyone has said what he wants to say. It's gone on for a long time. It's time to come to a conclusion." That will not happen to us. We want it understood, not only by what we say, but by what we do, that we are discussing the nature of Stalinism and nothing else. For us, from that discussion, everything else flows.
Germany and Italy were defeated. They were not victorious. By an evolutionary process, some of the feudalistic features were lopped off in those countries, and then we had the definitive establishment of a bourgeois state by the unification of Italy and the unification of Germany, done partially through revolutionary wars, partially through bureaucratic actions under the aegis of feudalistic politicians, all done under the formal aegis of the monarchy. I cite these instances not to draw any analogy between the bourgeois revolutions or the establishment of the bourgeois state in those two countries with the course or to draw any pattern for the proletarian revolution and the destruction of capitalism. Because we know that the relationship of the proletariat to state power is far different than that of the bourgeoisie, which grew up right in the inside the womb of feudalism and was able to build sources of power before the within the fold for a while of the old class system. But as an illustration of the variegated processes of history, where this grandiose task of a new class formation was accomplished in such a startling different manner in the instances that I have cited. Now we're confronted with some new big facts in this post-war world. I don't intend in the time I'll speak to this convention in rehashing all of the arguments which have been pretty thoroughly covered in the internal bulletins, giving the underline in Comrade Hansen's document and Comrade Pablo's and my own, giving our underlying explanations and reasons why we said those states in Eastern Europe, those satellite states, were in no sense capitalist, but were of the same class type as the USSR. I want to here deal with, extend a few of the conclusions that must be drawn from our appreciation of this new world we're living in the new world in the sense of the transformations that have occurred since the Second World War. We have big fact number one, the startling weakening of imperialism by the wrenching of whole vast sections of the globe from out of its grip. In addition to the one-sixth of the world that has been wrenched out of imperialism's hold by the October Revolution, we have today imperialism's grip wrenched in the case of China, in the case of the satellite countries, which comprise roughly some half of Europe. And we have these degenerated, bastardized forms of development occurring because while the objective situation is rotten ripe 10 times over for this revolutionary transformation, the subjective factor has lagged behind so badly by the weakness of the Fourth International, the continued influence of Stalinism, which necessarily puts its imprint in the first period of the revolutionary transformations on all sectors of the labor movement and all signs of change which it has power over and which it has influence over. Now, Stalinism, today I don't think it's so startling anymore to say in the discussion, is a unique labor bureaucracy. It has similarities with all previous labor bureaucracies that we have known, but it's not the same. It's different. It's similar to the social democratic labor bureaucracy in many, many instances, but it's not exactly a reformist bureaucracy in the sense that we have known social democracy, in whether in classic or degenerated form. It's different because it has demonstrated, for one, that under certain unique circumstances, it can not only do battle with the bourgeoisie in the sense of taking the leadership of a vast mass movement, which social democracy can do also, but that it can crush that bourgeoisie, as it has done in China. Nobody that looks at this sorrowful, sinful world we live in can deny what has happened there. The Johnsonites aren't interested in it. They're not interested in this living world, so it's no special surprise. And take political power, leaving aside for the moment the class character of China, which I'll say a word on later on in the discussion. In that sense, they are unlike the traditional reformist labor bureaucracy, which under no circumstances showed its ability, regardless of how stormy the movement that it was forced to lead. It never showed the ability of breaking the old state structure and taking power under a new structure, under a new form, and with new forces based on different class formations. Now, Stalinism, as we know, has gone through many evolutionary changes in its 25-odd years of existence. Like all living formations, it has been subjected to the various pressures of conflicting forces and the influences at every given time of the labor movement. What has always been Stalinism, even less than reformism, has any definite social philosophy. They can be the wildest, most adventuristic leftists. They can be the most fantastic opportunists and class collaborationists. The constant always in Stalinism has been its determination to control the labor movement and to utilize it for its own narrow aims and purposes in the USSR for the preservation of the power and the privileges of the oligarchy that rules there. And now we see a change that has occurred in Stalinism, although it really isn't Stalinism because that change has occurred. In the process of these vast changes in the post-war world, we have seen first a Communist Party break away as an entity. We have always taken into consideration, and the old man has written many times about breakaways of Stalinist movements. We always conceived of it more in the nature of splits occurring inside of Communist parties. Breaking away as an entity with the old Stalinist leadership, transforming itself into a new type of left-centrist leadership in the process of the transformation of its party and its movement. We've seen a party in China where information is still scanty, and we cannot say too much definitively on that score, of undoubtedly a loosening of the bonds with the Kremlin, and the development of a party which has state power and is forced to institute great changes in the social life and structure of that vast country, and still riding on top of this great vast upheaval, which surely historians will put down as probably the greatest event in our lifetime that has thus far occurred after the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917. My time is up, and I want a little bit of extension of time, if I may have it.
Any objections? Okay.
I don't know. It won't. I'll make it as short as I can. I got to answer them. I got Marcy. I got. Can't blame me for all that, can you? Now, our big task, from the point of view of strategic objectives, our movement has to identify itself with all these great progressive movements that are starting in the world, and which, for the moment, are under the leaderships of Stalinists or near-Stalinists, and we have to consider all of these as parts of the process of the world revolution. And by that I include the Yugoslav revolution, where it's far more clearer to all of us because the break with the Kremlin has been overt. I include identifying ourselves with the progressive measures that have been taken in Eastern Europe, and of course this great revolution in China, which is still in progress, and which for the moment is still led by the Chinese Stalinist leadership. We do that, and we have to do that, because we go on the perspective and certainty that sooner or later, this vast process of mass upheaval and mass change, which represents the first stages here of the world revolution in the post-war epoch, will rise high enough, the tide will get great enough, where it will sweep over the heads of the bureaucracy and permit the organization of a new leadership through whatever processes and vicissitudes which will be able to give authentic voice and which will be able to begin redirecting the whole vast movement along more classic and Bolshevik channels, along the general lines and with the general strategy of the 1917 October Revolution. Now, the question is not so paramount today. It was asked in slightly modified form by many people before of us. This conundrum that the Johnsonites posed here this afternoon, and which I first was confronted with in Detroit. How can the grave diggers of a revolution be leading a revolution? Well, this is a typical example of people who get themselves entrapped in a formula which they don't understand to boot, and feel completely satisfied with the straitjacket that they have put on themselves, and don't feel any necessity even of reconsidering or thinking what's the relation of the formula to reality. China, which is going through a vast upheaval, what's going on there? No answer, no feeling of a necessity for an answer, because a vast upheaval of 450 million people is less important than a formula which they don't understand into the bargain. You might ask, how can counter-revolutionists, which Stalinists are, lead strikes in America, often very militant strikes, and very often lead them to victory, or sometimes lead them to victory? Of course, the answer to the conundrum is that Stalinism, and this is, we don't need any new revelation for that. The old man has completely laid out his analysis of Stalinism correctly for us, which explains that. Stalinism is a contradictory phenomenon which utilizes struggles. It doesn't oppose all struggles. It's not a counter-revolutionary force in the sense of the Black Legion, or in the sense of the White Guards in old Russia, or in the sense of a fascist movement. It's a contradictory labor bureaucracy. It utilizes struggles. It assumes the leadership of struggles. It doesn't always betray incidental struggles, even when it happens to suit its blackmailing purposes. But it always utilizes these with two paramount thoughts in mind, which always govern as constants of its policy. One, that it must have the dictatorial power over this struggle and labor movement. And two, that it can only to complete that thought, so that it will never permit it to rise to any levels which will challenge its own unquestioned might and dictatorship over the labor movement. And two, that it views all these struggles always simply as small change, as checkerboard pawns for its fundamental aim, which is to get concessions or drive back capitalist aggression against themselves for the preservation of their own power and privileges in their own domain in the USSR. And that's why you seek the contradiction, which is not one of logic, but the contradictory formation of life, where a group of counter-revolutionary organization always leads great militant struggles. We have been confronted with that time and again in America, and now it has risen to these great heights where it has fallen into the leadership of a great revolution. But as Stalinists, they always view this influence over the labor movement along the lines I have indicated. And so life itself there solves the problem for us and at the same time shows how we're dealing with a contradictory formation which has to be understood in its two-sided makeup. You just let me ride along and I'll do the best I can with the tools I got. I'm not going to take more than 5 minutes or six. Put it up to the body if you wish.
How much the point is this now? This convention decided for 10 minutes limitation of speeches from the floor. That was your decision. Now it's up to you what you want to do with it. I think you should live within it.
You want
to extend the time to come and cover?
If I may
17 and a half minutes now.
If I may say an explanation. I believe I'm entitled to a few extra minutes because I have the special views on Eastern Europe that I have to say something about. I have to say a word or two on the difference between us and the Marcy policy, which has been enunciated. Otherwise, it was hardly worth. There was no point in speaking.
No, it's not me who's objecting. I'm just trying to uphold the system of the convention. Let's have a. Go ahead.
Now, Comrade Weiss's suggestion that the East European states, while capitalism has been wiped out there, and they're now part or seem to be becoming part of the USSR, but he does not believe that the term worker state applies correctly, as in his mind that means that the state originated with a classic revolution, I believe narrows down the difference to pretty much where it becomes a terminological one, or you might even go so far as to say a quibble. The basic thing that I saw of importance and those comrades whose views coincided with mine when we proposed opening the discussion on this score was that these states in Eastern Europe were of the same class type as that of the USSR. And because of that, our tactical line would have to be governed very similarly to the tactical line we employ in the USSR without going through its various sections. And once that is agreed upon, then our tactical line coincides from our appreciation that we're dealing with the USSR forms of class types and not capitalism. And what remains of differences is pretty much of third-rate character. I don't even know whether they're worth too much debate or discussion. In one sense, you can say, if this will make Comrade Weiss or others any happier about it, in one sense, you can say that they have been integrated into the state structure of the USSR. But then, of course, you have to add that that integration is of a different type. It's a different integration than was the case of Eastern Poland or the Baltics or the Ukraine as part of the USSR and so on. Now, we have... In the World Resolution of 1948, the official document stated and spoke that a third world war in the form of an attack of world imperialism under American leadership against the USSR is inevitable if successful socialist revolutions do not materialize in the interim, if the contest between the USSR and world imperialism is confined, however, to military means, the defeat and destruction of the USSR is certain. Now, I believe we already have to bring that section up to date, and we have to say that it's now already clear that the next world war is not going to be fought as a war with purely military means. Look at what happened in Korea as a harbinger of events to come. In a sense, a fight in the Cold War between the two great powers of the world. A civil war in Korea. The civil war measures of a class character introduced in the course of the Civil War to help the military fight along if for no other reason. You can see that the coming war is going to, from the first day, going to be intertwined in the most immediate way with all kinds of upheavals, uprisings, civil wars, measures introduced of a class character, and vast changes to awaken populations and get their enthusiasm behind one of the military sides. And in that sense, America is going to be confronted from almost the first day of the war, not purely with a military struggle against the USSR, but against the rising civil war and rising class struggles. But here is where the Marcyites are so off the track and so completely wrong, and why their whole theory, not only is all that it was stated in the previous discussion, but why it doesn't aid us in our revolutionary tasks, but puts the greatest stumbling block in the way. As these civil wars arise, the role of the you're not going to have them all line up in one of the camps here against American imperialism and the other camp, but as they rise in every case where they threaten to get out of hand of the Kremlin rulers, in every case where they rise independently of the Kremlin squads and agents, the Kremlin forces, as they have demonstrated only too clearly in Yugoslavia, can, even at the expense of their struggle with American imperialism, undermine and work to smash and crush movements which militarily they could utilize, because their fear of independent movements is even greater than weakening their military front, as their whole history has shown in the Second World War and in the events of the aftermath. And that's why, if for no other reason, this two-camp schema is the worst blow you can strike at a correct strategic orientation of the revolutionary forces. Because in the germ of truth that the Third World War is going to be a great upheaval here of civil wars and vast uprisings, they're not going to be in the second camp of the Kremlin. They're not only going to be in a different camp from the Kremlin, but they're going to have to defend themselves arms in hand against the Kremlin at least as much as they will against the forces of imperialism on the other side. And that's one of the most telltale things, as well as your viewing Stalin's depredation and Stalin's imposition of unequal and robber treaties on China as a great progressive act which shows the class affinity between China and the USSR. I view it the other way. I am hoping for the break of the Mao Zedong leadership from the Kremlin, as the Tito leadership broke from the Kremlin. And I view the imposition of robber treaties as something that's got to be not hailed, but resisted and fought. And one of the great lines of our propaganda to produce a break in China between the perfidious Kremlin leadership and its role and what it intends to do with the Chinese mass movement and that revolution which for the moment is headed by a leadership of uncertain Stalinist complexion. I'll leave out of the question for the moment of the class character of China, as I'm sure my colleague here, Comrade Hansen, is going to take that up and conclude with this. I feel very glad of the whole discussion that we have had since February or a little prior to February, as I believe that it has, faster than I had anticipated when we started the discussion, and in a far calmer and more comradely atmosphere than I anticipated would be in the case in February as well, has broken through what I consider certain doctrinaire blinders that people were wearing, and we have now been able to bring up to date our basic philosophy so that we are encompassing in it all these great new events of the post-war epoch. And once we did that, I knew it would only take 5 minutes for us to be able to draw the correct and logical practical tasks and tactics for our movement to follow, which give us a correct position and an answer of what our role is, how we envisage the next stages of for the growth and the breaking through of the Fourth International, and how we stand on Yugoslavia, and how we stand on China, and how we stand on Bessarabia. And I'm sure after Comrade Murray's remarks, we won't have too much difficulty either in arriving at an agreement on how we stand on Eastern Europe.
Comrades, I think everybody recognizes that we have to stretch our rules a little bit to serve our main purpose here. Several of the NC comrades generously gave me a part of their time so that I could develop the collective thinking on this question that we've been doing this summer in one presentation. The subject under discussion is so vast, so inclusive, and so decisive for the future of our movement that it's literally impossible to cover it in a long report of an hour and a half or even in one discussion of the whole convention. We'll obviously continue the discussion afterward. Now, as I see what is taking place in our international movement today, is that a great collective intellectual effort of our international movement is being brought to bear with increasing intensity upon the new problems that have confronted us, the disciples of Trotsky, 10 years after his death. I believe you all know the role that Trotsky played in the construction of our movement. He was the heir of the Russian Revolution. He was the embodiment of the history and the practice and the theory of the Marxist movement, the formulator of the program which created the cadres of the Fourth International. When Trotsky was among us, the complicated problems of that time were answered quicker and more surely because of the role that he played. Now, our task as the disciples of Trotsky has been to assimilate 10 years of history, which included 5 years of war and 5 years of post-war developments, without his help, but by means of his method that he taught us. The very fact that 10 years after the death of Trotsky, his movement exists and grapples with world problems and tries to find in every one of them the basis for revolutionary action, that in itself is the greatest testimony to the correctness and the revolutionary vitality of the ideas and the method that he gave to us. But our discussion is taking time, taking longer, and it had to proceed by stages. You recall that we first had to fight, after the end of the World War, we had to fight those who challenged the basic positions of Trotskyism. Some of you young people may not remember, it seems so long ago, that, but we were one time fighting with Moroites over the question of whether Trotskyism was valid anymore.
The right wing in France who were in conciliatory toward Stalinism because they were under the pressure of the Stalinist movement here, just like the pitiful Moroites in this country were under the pressure of American imperialism. Then we had to fight the phenomenon of this right wing in the United States and this pro-Stalinist wing in France in a bloc trying to break up our international and reduce all its program to trash. Then we had pompous sectarian screwballs like Moonis taking up our time in the first 5 years of the post-war, of the post-Trotsky epoch. All that's been cleared out of the way. And now, the discussion is proceeding among the genuine Trotskyists themselves. That is the orthodox Trotskyists, who are the only Trotskyists there are. And this discussion is a very lively one and a quite different one. From all indications, it's moving rapidly now to solid agreements on all the most important questions. And here's a strange phenomenon in the world today. As far as I can observe, the Trotskyists are the only ones who are discussing the new events that are popping up from month to month. The right-wing revisionists, for the most part, all those who attempted to revise our program in the past 10 years or more, have pretty much gone over in the camp of imperialism, and they have no more problems to settle. No more discussions are needed. The Shachmanites are not discussing as lively and feverishly as they used to. The only discussion I can observe taking place in their ranks, from what reading I do of their press, is that they got another social patriotic wing, and they're arguing with them in a comradely way as to whether it's quite correct to support the American imperialists in the Korean War and other places. The Shachmanites are great agriculturists. They raise a new crop of social patriots once every year. And I heard that they're improving their fertilizing methods and are going in for a two crop a year. I was struck by the fact that the Johnsonites don't want to discuss either. Why? Not from the point of view of the Shachmanites, that they're so far over into the other camp. I don't say all the Shachmanites are social imperialists. I say half of them are already pretty frank imperialists, and the others are neutral in favor of American imperialism. Now, the Johnsonites don't want to discuss the new events because they've got all problems solved already in a closed system. That's a very comfortable position to be, to stand, be able to stand up and say, we will not debate this, we say that, that is not important. After you've done so-and-so, then we will do so-and-so. That's all right if you like religion, where you get all problems settled at one shot, and then you don't have to worry and discuss and have any more divisions in your ranks anymore. When you say you are in complete unanimity and you don't have any discussions or difference of opinion among yourselves, that only convinces me that what you've got is not a lively political program subject to various interpretation under the stress of events. You've got a closed dogma.
I don't like dogmas. I don't like churches or popes. I had one. I got rid of him, and I don't want any more. I say the best proof of the genuine revolutionary vitality of Trotskyism is that it has all kinds of different points of view. You can see that reflected in our committee.